All right, and as I had stated earlier, my name is John. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm going to be your 10-minute speaker. Good morning. I'm turning 40 on Thursday. And I was in my garage tinkering around trying to build a cabinet, which I was not doing too well yesterday. And I wasn't sure what I was going to do in terms of how I was going to address you all in this meeting. And for some reason, amidst the frustration of trying to put together a cabinet, it dawned on me that I didn't think I was going to live to 40 not too long ago. On April 23rd, 2017 is when I decided that I was going to try and become sober. It wasn't that day that I finalized that, but that was the day that it occurred to me that I needed help. Because at that point, I no longer wanted to be alive. I did not want to live. I didn't care how it happened. I just was too chicken to do it myself. And that day was an interesting day. That day was supposed to be, I had a daddy-daughter dance. I have three kids. I was going to take my oldest daughter to a dance. But in the morning, I was not in my hometown. I was in Santa Barbara, actually. I run an office. I'm an attorney. And I took my office to an office trip in Santa Barbara. At night, the night before the 23rd, so on the 22nd, I'm a garbage head. I'm the kind of person that likes to do whatever is around me in order to get a head change. And between the Percocet, the Coke, and the fifth of vodka, it was a fun night. And I woke up the next morning normal with my headache and sweats and tremors. And so it's about 7 a.m. on a beautiful oceanfront Santa Barbara morning, and I needed to drink bad. Because I knew I had to get in the car and drive everybody back to Hanford here shortly. And somewhere at that time, it started to occur to me pretty prevalently that I was not okay. Because I knew I wasn't going to be able to make a trip home with office people in my car without getting buzzed. Because I knew I couldn't get drunk, because then that would be too much. It would be too obvious, too close proximity. I had to drink enough vodka to where you would definitely be able to smell it, even though people want to say vodka has no smell. Trust me. I knew I wasn't fooling anybody at that point any longer. So I knew they'd be able to smell it on me. So I had to keep it cool. I had to try and tone it back, do what I could do to get through the day, through the morning, actually. And I did. And I remember I took pictures of myself. I took selfies on a beach in Santa Barbara, drunk at 7 a.m., watching the sun come up, thinking like, this is the life. And I managed to, the funny thing was, actually, I remember one of the people in the car was, we saw the bottle in, underneath your seat, but we didn't want to say anything later. And I was like, good, because it had just pissed me off at that point. But they knew. I didn't know it at that time, but they knew. And when I got home, I was safe home now. So I had a couple hours before I had to take my daughter to a daddy-daughter dance. And so I proceeded. I think I finished the fifth. I don't really remember. And I took her to a daddy-daughter dance. And when I got home, it was confrontational. I've been living this way for years and years and years before that. And I didn't really care at all. I didn't care what my kids thought of me. I cared. I didn't care. I didn't want them to know the truth. I didn't care what their true feelings were, but I didn't want them to know my truth. Because that I had to hide. The show had gone on for too long. I just didn't have the heart to give it to them all at both barrels at once. My wife, I'd lie to her about whether or not I took trash out or something. I didn't care what it was, but it didn't matter. The truth didn't have any value anymore. Not even in my own mind, because at that point, I started losing the sense of what was true and what wasn't true. If I could just utter a response to get people off of my back, that was the response that mattered. And I think, I mean, in my mind, for having, you know, decades of drinking under my belt. I mean, God's sakes, my parents owned a liquor store. It wasn't anything that was uncommon. It was asked to me by my wife, do you think your kids deserve to have a drunk as a father? Ruined it for me at that moment. Around that time, April 2017, I wanted to die. I wasn't a praying man at that time, but the one thing I prayed for was that God would find a way to take it from me, because I couldn't do it on my own. Take my life, please, is the only thing I prayed for. In tears, when nobody else was looking. And I knew, my belief was, and that's what hit me yesterday, I had the belief that I'm not going to live till 40. I was okay with that. I was at peace with that. It was almost a joke in my mind, because I knew everybody else around me didn't know that that was what was in my head. They don't even know I'm going to be gone here. Good. I don't care. I don't care. Get me away. That was life. But when I was asked whether or not my kids deserve to have a drunk as a father, that bugged me. Who the heck was anybody else to tell me who I was or wasn't? Well, they were right for doing it. But at the time, for some reason, that lit a fire under me. And so I signed up to go to treatment that day, that night. Funny, I didn't expect them to tell me, great, we'll see you here tomorrow. Okay. But I did. Not before I got in the car after having, you know, another pill and some vodka. And I showed up to treatment. I was honest and I was up front. But I never said I wanted to be sober. I only said I wanted to be happy. What are you here for? I want to be happy. I just wanted to be happy. I didn't want to feel like I wanted to die. Because I was there. I didn't like the way I felt. And it's just a horrible way to keep on going living, just asking for something to happen to you. So I said, I just want to be happy. And that first day, they made me go to an AA meeting in rehab. Can you believe that? They asked me, do you want to go? I was like, no, I'm okay right here, thank you. They said, no, why don't you come with us? So I did, thinking, great. It's the best meeting of my life. It was it rivals with one of the best moments of my life. My first meeting, they give me something to read. I'm pretty sure I had to read, you know, more about alcoholism. And I went up there and I said, my name is John, I'm an alcoholic? Like with a question mark. And then they had somebody, it was a speaker meeting. And the speaker was telling my story right back at me. And from that moment forward, I had a chance. From that moment forward, I believed that maybe I'm not nuts. I'm not an alien. I'm not somebody that didn't belong here. I actually might have something to think about, to live for. Because everybody would tell me, don't you want to live for your family? Don't you want to live for all these wonderful things? I don't really care. That didn't register with me. A glimmer of hope is what registered with me. Just a glimmer of hope that life can be something more than just pain and trying to mask that pain. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous gave to me the first day I showed up. So I consider my sobriety date was not the day I went in. It was April 25th, 2017. And I love being able to look back at the fact and say, that's the day something died. That's the day something died that I am so glad died, and it just wasn't my life. And since I've come back and keep coming back and keep coming back and keep coming back without stepping out, every day has brought me a little further away from the day where I was when I finally just couldn't take it anymore. crazy to me. It's absolutely mind-blowing. As I sat there yesterday in my garage thinking how I can't believe almost 3 years ago, I would have said, I'm never going to get to 40. I will be dead, thank God. Versus 2 years later, I'm just happy to be in my garage messing around. Such a strange trip if you just stick around and maybe do something that's suggested. And I have a lot to thank to the person that's going to be our speaker today. So when I was asked to be the chair for today, I went and I told my kids, and they didn't get it. They know I'm in recovery. I educated them because after treatment I learned that all of my relatives had passed away from alcoholism. I didn't even know that. I didn't know that every one of my grandparents died from either cirrhosis, suicide, heart attack. I can't remember all of them, but everybody was gone because of alcohol. I'm the first person to ever go to treatment in my family. I'm the first person to go to AA. So once I learned that I had this disease, I sent my children to a school at Betty Ford to educate them on the disease. So when I tell them I'm going to a meeting, have fun, Dad. When I used to tell my children that I was going somewhere 2 years ago, they got relief. I'm leaving. Thank God. They'd be excited when I'd leave. And I know this is where I belong because on that April 24th, the morning I left for treatment, I told my kids I'm going away and I'm not going to drink anymore. They cried. And it wasn't because I was leaving. I told them what I was doing and they said, "You mean you're not going to drink anymore?" I said, "No." Then they cried. I have a normal relationship with my children now. I have hope that I'm actually going to retire maybe one day. I'm going to make it, hopefully, God willing, to 40. I don't dread it. I embrace it. And it's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I am going to stay. That's it. There's going to be a 10-minute break before our speaker. If you need time, go outside. But thank you, everybody. Many of you know the person who's going to be the speaker tonight. And I'd say you're lucky. We're all very lucky to have today's speaker. A man who is very, very, very important to me. I love him. I'd like to introduce Bear. Bear, would you come up?
I'm Bear, and I'm a very grateful alcoholic. I'd like to thank Brent and the rest of the committee for having me. I tell everybody I'm on standby for just about anything you want, you know. The Bakersfield contingent, welcome. Glad to see you guys here. You know, I spent most of the night last night trying to figure out what I was going to say, because I would say probably 70% of the people in this room have already heard my story. So the truth is I'm not here if you've got probably 20 or 30 years of sobriety. I'm here if you're new in this program. How many here have less than 1 year? Please raise your hand. Outstanding. Yes. Yes. You guys are probably the ones that I'm talking to. The rest of you guys, go back to sleep. You know, in the process of thinking of what I was going to say, I kept wondering, you know, I have more time today in sobriety than I did when I was drinking. I stopped drinking when I was 35 years old. I'm 72 now. couple years ago, my sponsor turned to me and said, "You know, you have not only been sober for half your life, but you've been sober for longer than you've been drinking." And I went, "Whoa, that's exciting. I never thought I was going to make it beyond a week, if you will." So I'd like to tell you how I started out. You know, I'm from Pennsylvania. Hard-drinking bunch of people, coal miners, steel workers. I used to go to the bar with my uncle at the Moose Club and watch him down a shot and a glass of beer. And it, always the first one was down. I mean, he'd take the shot and then he'd drink the glass of beer right behind it and put the empty glass down on the bar and usually say, "I'll have another." There were a couple times that my cousin and I helped him drive home. I don't know how, you know, on the way up here today, I got to thinking about it. You know, I've often told the people that I sponsor and other folks, joking around with them, saying that I'm kind of hoping that I'm going to die in my sleep, unlike the rest of the screaming passengers in the car with me. So on the way up here, I thought, geez, I haven't had much sleep last night. I hope I don't do this now. But, you know, there was a judge back in Mahoning County, where I come from in western Pennsylvania, that told my grandparents, as they're sitting in the front of the courtroom, "The young man that's in front of me now, I don't ever want to see him again." So there are four gentlemen back there in the back with uniforms on. He needs to talk to one of them because I want his ass out of my county. Now, my grandparents pretty much knew what was going on. And I felt really bad at that time. See, because once again, I was before the same judge. And I hadn't even made it to 17 years old yet. See? And I went and I had to get my grandmother to sign for me at 17 in order to join the United States Navy. Now, I saw the poster numerous times with a drunken sailor with a Dixie cup back in his head, leaning up against the light post, and I just knew he was drunk. And I knew that's what I wanted to be. So I did that. I joined the Navy. Greatest thing that ever happened to me, I retired, I don't know, 40 or 50 years ago, something like that. And it's paying my mortgage and bills and all that good stuff, you know. The Navy's been really good to me. The government's been really good to me. You know, I'm dressed the way I am today because I respect all of you. I love all of you, whether you believe it or not. There may be a few people out there that I don't like, and that's okay. You know what I'm saying? God bless all of you. Man, that's great. Anyhow, on my Navy stint for 20 years, I did an awful lot of things. I've been on, under, and over the North Pole. I've been on and over the South Pole. I did polar exploring. I've been to Norway, Sweden, Greenland, Iceland. Oh, the tropics of the North, Iceland. Great place. The land of fire and ice. Did a little few stints in Canada, Alaska. Did a lot of things. Most of it was drunk. You know, when I went to Sweden, I went to a pub there in Sweden. And it's like this in Iceland, too. You know, you walk into a bar here, and if you sit four or five stools down, matter of fact, on the other side of the bar, that might be too close for us around here, you know. But in the northern regions, they belly up to the bar as tight as they can possibly get. I mean, my buddies and I are standing at the bar and we're like this, and there's a gentleman that came in and squeezed in between us. I guess it's because they wanted to be warm. I don't know, you know. There have been a few fights over that. And, you know, I mean, when you're in, you know, the culture, you got to be able to respect that culture, you know. And a few of the things that I've done, I don't remember. There are people that had to tell me. Now, probably the most embarrassing thing for this drunk is for somebody to tell me that I did something and I don't remember doing it, nor do I believe them, because I couldn't do something like that. You know? And when it come down to it, when I found out what the truth was, I did do it. Did I have some regret? Did I have some remorse? Why, most certainly I did. Do you think it stopped me from drinking? No. As a matter of fact, that was impetus enough to go on ahead and have some more. Because I figured the God of my understanding was not a very forgiving God. He was on that big cloud with a long white beard, a long white robe, and a book there beside him. And my name was on the top of that book with all kinds of check marks. And I looked at those check marks and I said, you know what? I got enough of them up there, I might as well add some more. And I did. I did. Some I remember, some I don't. But most of the time, I was still filled with regret and remorse. Especially the next morning. I don't know if anybody can identify with this or not. My head was as big as this room. My mouth was dry. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, if I just had a hair of the dog, I would be okay. So I would get a little bit of the hair of the dog, you know, a beer, a shot, whatever it was, you know. And I would start out again. How many times have I said, I am never going to do this again? I cannot do this again. 9:30, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock in the morning rolls around. Somebody says, let's go have a beer. I'm not able to comprehend a beer, okay? Maybe some people can, but I can't. It's incomprehensible. When I have a beer, it leads to A, B, C, D, all the way to Z, and back out again. That's my MO. So the insanity of my drinking is if I don't do the same thing that I did last night, things are probably going to change a little bit, and I'm going to be better off. I'm off and running. I can never have one. And 1,000's not enough until I pass out. And when I pass out, I would come to with that dry mouth, the head as big as this room, saying, God, I don't know what happened. What happened? I started out thinking that all I wanted to do was just have one beer. Just have one beer and socialize with these people. And by the time I had the fifth beer, the people that I was with are gone. They're gone. When I was in the Navy and before I got sober, there were people who would say, let's go out and have a beer, but let's keep Paul out of it. The first time I heard that, I kind of went, huh? And finally, I approached one of my friends and I said, you guys don't want me to drink with you anymore? And they said, well, there's some people that seem to feel that you're not right. You drink too much. And you do too many things that embarrass them and yourself. And maybe you ought to think about quitting. It's not my friend anymore. He was a friend, but he's not anymore. What do you mean to tell me I can't quit drinking? Or who are you to tell me that I can quit drinking? I had reached a point in my life where I could neither drink successfully or not drink successfully. The Navy decided to do something about that and sent my ass to rehab. Now, what happened was, is I came home after a three-day drunk. I got into an argument with my wife. I put a hole in the wall. I broke a full-length mirror. And when I came out of my blackout, my command master chief was sitting in the living room with me and my wife. I understood the point of the conversation that they were having, and the point of the conversation was me. And I did my usual thing, my best thing that I've been able to do all my drinking career, as I did my best to change the subject. I wanted to be able to talk about something else besides me, because I knew what was coming down. About an hour or so later, my command master chief turned to me as he was leaving, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, I don't know what the time was. He said, I want you in my office at 7:30 sharp. And I said, okay, will do, master chief. I walked into his office and I did the normal thing. I walked into his office and I sat down on his couch right across from his desk. He turned and he looked at me and said, Chief, I do not want you sitting on my couch. I want you at attention in front of me. I looked at him and I said, you're kidding. He says, no, I'm not kidding, sailor. Get up there and stand at 2. I went, holy smokes. There's probably a pretty good chance I'm in trouble. He picked up the phone. He said, yes, sir. Yes, sir. He hung the phone up. He said, follow me. I went into my CO's office. As I'm walking through the CO's office, the secretary's office is right there in the front. And she looked at me like this, and her eyes went down, and I knew I was in trouble. I stood in front of my commanding officer, and he said, Chief, you got to understand something. I went through the enlisted ranks alongside of this guy in his officer ranks. He and I had been stationed together 2 or 3 times. He knew my MO. He knew what was going on. And he had two folders in front of his desk there. He said, Chief, you are probably one of the finest sailors that I've ever had the opportunity to work with. He said, you've got a problem, and I'm going to help you solve your problem. And this folder here is going to help you solve your problem. I'm going to send your ass to rehab. And this folder over here, I'm going to have your ass out of my Navy by Friday. Now, I'm a betting man, somewhat of a sea lawyer. Never got my degree, but I'm a somewhat of a sea lawyer, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, I'm not quite sure that he can do that. And then I got to thinking back about the times that he and I were stationed together, and it occurred to me that there was at least 2 times that I know of that I saw somebody that was in my command, and within a couple of days, they weren't in my command anymore. I went, okay. I said, Skipper, I think I ought to go to rehab. He says, wise choice, sailor. Wise choice. He said, the command master chief is going to escort you down to the rehab center now. Huh? The command master chief turned to me and said, I'm not escorting your ass anywhere. You know where the rehab center is. You go down there and you see a man by the name of Mr. Peterson. He's going to help you out. I went, okay. Well, they trust me enough to get in my car and drive down to the rehab center. I got this thing made, you know. I got there and I saw Mr. Peterson, and Mr. Peterson kind of reminded me of a bulldog sitting behind his desk, you know, just like, big man, big man. And he says, here's what I want you to do, Chief. He says, he handed me a piece of paper, and he said, I want you to take this down to the dispensary, have this prescription filled. I turned and I looked and I says, what's this prescription? He says, it's antabuse. I says, what the hell is antabuse? He says, if you take this and you drink, you're going to get terribly sick. You might even die. Huh? Why would you want me to do something like that? I flipped it back on his desk and I said, you know, I can do okay without having that stuff. I can do okay with, you know, I can spend a little time not drinking. He picked the paper up and he handed it back to me as he picks his phone up. Anybody remember this? He dials a number. Says, yes, sir. Yes, sir. And he hands me the phone. Guess who it is on the other end? My commanding officer. He said, Chief, if you don't do exactly what that gentleman in front of you does, I'm going to have your ass out of my Navy. Pronto. I said, yes, sir. Will do. I hung the phone up and I turned to Mr. Peterson and I said, what do you want me to do, sir? I'm able to stand up in a corner and shit in a stump and do all that stuff. He says, you don't need to do any of that stuff. What you need to do is you need to take the prescription down to the dispensary, get it filled, and be back up here. And I want you back here in 20 minutes. I says, 20 minutes? I can do it in 10. He says, I'm going to give you some rope in case you go by the club. That really pissed me off, you know. Now, this gentleman not only called me an alcoholic, he used the F word in front of it, you know. And I took offense to that. I knew that there was probably a pretty good chance I was an alcoholic, but guess what? Hey, the only difference between me and an alcoholic as I'm sitting at the bar is alcoholics go to those damn meetings and I don't. Guess what? I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous probably six times a week, sometimes seven, sometimes twice a day. So I went to rehab. The first time I went to rehab, or the first time I went to a meeting, I had my arms crossed, my eyes crossed, my legs crossed, and any other part of my body was crossed. Because I didn't think, see, I was a chief petty officer in the United States Navy. You couldn't teach me anything. You couldn't tell me anything. Get sober? Well, heck, when I was stationed in Guam, and my wife and I were both in the Navy, and she, before we left from Hawaii to go to Guam, she said, I think you're an alcoholic, but, you know, I'm not entirely sure. And I said, well, I'll prove to you that I'm not. And she says, well, how are you going to do that? I says, I'll go for 30 days without having a drink. No beer or nothing, you know. And about 2 weeks before we left and 2 weeks after we got to Guam, I turned to her and I said, there, see, I'm not an alcoholic. I spent 30 days without having a drink. She says, you're absolutely right. You're probably not an alcoholic. I said, see you later. I'm going to the club. I don't think I made it home that night. I'm not entirely sure. I'm one of those type of drunks where I would look in the refrigerator and see that there was milk or something that was needed. And I'd say, hey, look, we need a gallon of milk, okay? I'm going to go to the store. Okay. Did I get the milk? I most certainly did. But it usually got sour after 3 days sitting in a hot car. The bread? It was usually moldy by the time I made it home. And I'd have to go out and make another run. Well, jeez, to make another run like that, it's a, well, I might as well have a little hair of the dog. Why not? Stop by my favorite club. Have a couple beers. I'm a drunk. I'm an alcoholic. When you say couple, I kind of went, a couple means four or five anyhow, at least, if not more. So, anyhow, I learned to get into service real quick. I don't think it was after I got out of... Yeah, maybe it was after I got out of rehab. I went to a huge meeting, and it was a hall bigger than this. It was a dining hall for a school. And they had round tables, I mean big round tables, not like these, but tables that are split in the middle where you had to bring them up, you know, and they had wheels on them and that. And after the meeting, and it was an hour and a half meeting. This is great. I love this. You know, I'm in civilian clothes. I'm a chief in the Navy. I have four or five, maybe six people working for me. Whenever I want something done, I'll look for my third class or my seaman. You know, somebody that's working for me, have them do it, you know. After the meeting, they were folding up the clothes. And a young fellow, a little squirt, probably maybe 5'2", 5'3", walks up to me and hands me a broom and says, "Hey, help sweep the floor." I let that broom slide back to him and looked at him and said, "You know, partner, I got four or five people that sweep floors for me. I don't need to be sweeping any floors." And right behind me, I could swear the thumb was in the middle of my back and the fingers were stretched over top of my shoulder, coming down about this far. I turned around and looked, and this Hawaiian guy had me by at least 400 pounds. And he kind of shakes my shoulder and said, "Brother, you go on ahead, sweep the floor. We talk about it later." That was fun. That gentleman's name is Big Richard. And his sponsor was a gentleman by the name of Harry Lake. And my sponsor was Big Richard's sponsor. Or my sponsor, how's that work now? My sponsor had a sponsor, which was Big Richard. And there was a time, I can't remember where I was, 6 months, 9 months, might have been a year. After a meeting, and you know, this happens an awful lot in AA meetings. We have a meeting before the meeting, a meeting during the meeting, and a meeting after the meeting. Now, the meeting after the meeting usually is a coffee house or someplace like that, someplace where you can go have a cup of coffee, shoot the breeze, you know. The first liar doesn't have a chance. And I was at the coffee house one time with my sponsor and his sponsor, Big Richard. And I was kind of sitting on the end, and between my sponsor and Big Richard was a young man, probably in his early 20s, maybe late 20s. And he kept turning to Big Richard, or even my sponsor, and saying, "I got to go down to the ABC store and pick up a 12-pack. And my sponsor would turn to him and say, "No, you know, you got to wait until tomorrow, man. It's early yet." And getting at 10:30, 11 o'clock, something like that. This happens about four or five times, and this guy's getting antsy. He wants to get a beer. And they kept saying, "No, man, you got to wait until tomorrow." 1 minute after midnight, clicks, and he says, "There, it's tomorrow." And Big Richard looks at him and says, "You can't do it. It's today. You got to wait until tomorrow." Has anybody considered the fact that today is the tomorrow that you worried about yesterday? You know, I try to live my life today one day at a time. I'm not real good at it most of the time. You know, I do a lot of projecting. I'm retired now. I spent 45 years in the federal government. I spent a 5-year stint doing my own businesses, I had my own insurance agency. I had my own cleaning company. I was cleaning vinyl and loom siding. And I did all that in sobriety, you know, and I was doing all that stuff. And my sponsor at that particular time, not the guy that I was at the coffee house with, he got transferred. He moved on. So I'm driving this old guy the meetings. And I, about the fourth or fifth time or something like that, and I turned to him and I said, "Clancy, I need a sponsor." He looked at me and says, "Yeah." I said, "Well, would you be my sponsor?" He said, "Son, I've been sponsoring you probably ever since you walked in the door." He was the person that I did my fourth and fifth step for the third time. I didn't know this until I got to know him, when I would go by his place with my big book, and I meant to bring it today. I have a big book that's 38 years old. It's all torn and ripped and highlighted, and I love that book. There were often times he would turn to me and ask me about all my, you know, business ventures, if you would. And he would say, "You know, son, maybe you ought to slow down." I said, "Well, Clancy, what do you mean?" He said, "I think you got too many irons in the fire. You're going to get drunk." I went, "No way." This gentleman, at that particular time, had, I think it was 47 or 48 years. His sponsor was Dr. Bob. When Clancy spoke, people listened. I'll never forget the time I was sitting in a meeting one time, Clancy sitting by me, and there was a young man who was talking out of the side of his neck. Clancy got up and looked at him dead in the eye and pointed at him and said, "You need to shut your mouth, sit down, sit on your hands, and listen. And if you can't do that, leave this meeting and go to another meeting, because I ain't listening to your bullshit." Whoa! I was embarrassed for Clancy. I thought, can they do that at meetings? And I talked to Clancy about it later, and he said, "You know, son, you got to understand something. You're going to have the opportunity to meet all kinds of people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And some of them are going to walk in here and change the big book. They're going to make changes. They want to do this. They want to do that." He said, "We have had the mettle to be able to know what's right and what's wrong. So when somebody comes in here spouting off a bunch of shit, when you find out they've only got 6 days of sobriety, they need to shut their mouth." Okay, Clancy. But a few times that people got pissed off because I do the same thing. I'm sorry. No, I'm not sorry. I'm glad. I'm glad that there are people like me to let people know that this is a program that will kill you. It's a disease that will kill you. If you keep it up, you're going to die. Well, now people say, "Well, I'm going to die anyhow." Well, if you're drinking, and if you drink like I did, you may die, but you may die a real strange death and be the most miserable son of a bitch in the world. I plan on dying happy, to be honest with you. I'm not entirely sure whether I can or not, but I got news for you. I'm pretty damn happy now. I love coming to this meeting. You know, the other day, a young kid was saying something about the 12-pack or 6-pack or whatever it was, you know. And under my breath, and I said it in my loud voice, you know, I thought it was my inside voice. I apologized later. It was my outside voice. And I said, "Sounds reasonable to me." And I did at the time. The guy said, "I'm really having some problems, and I thought maybe I would go down and have a 12-pack of beer." Sounded reasonable to me. I'm an alcoholic. This guy is probably an alcoholic. If he wants to go down and have a 12-pack of beer, it's the most reasonable thing that I can think of. My only problem is, or my only issue that I have is, are you going to be the person that you were before you had the beer? Or are you going to be a different person after you drank the beer? And that's what I was. That's what I was, folks. He's passed away now. He was living down in Bakersfield, right? Matter of fact, Aaron, big black guy. I don't know if anybody recognizes or know who Aaron is. But Aaron used to say, I was always a nice guy until I installed the alcohol. And then I became Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And he would always say, the oughts and the ought-nots in the big book. He says, there are a lot of oughts and ought-nots in the big book. So I had to grab a hold of my big book, and I had to figure out how I was going to number all the oughts and the ought-nots, see. And there's a lot of them, believe me. You know, I can't remember now whether there's 32 or 37 musts in the first 164 pages. In order to stay sober, there are some things that you must do. One of the things that I have been able to recognize in my 38 years of sobriety is, number one, get my ass to meetings. Number two, talk with my sponsor. My sponsor is currently in a home down in San Diego. He's 82 years old and starting to lose it. He was in a home a couple times in Hanford up in Fresno. Now he's down in San Diego with his family. And so I'm in the market for another sponsor. But before I do that, I had to realize that I have an awful lot of sponsors in all of you. Whether you're drinking or not. If you're drinking, what that tells me is it's not any different out there. If you are not drinking and you're in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's probably a pretty doggone good chance that I'm going to understand who you are and where you're coming from. I don't even know what time I started. I don't even know how long I've said anything. What I would like to do, what I'd like to be able to do, is to let all of you know that if you're in this meeting to learn something, open your mind. Have some willingness. Be able to understand that the part of this program is the how. Honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. If you're closed-minded and you can't get it, it's okay. We're still going to love you. It's okay. You can come back in the door. There's a very dear friend of mine that passed away a couple months ago. His name is Gary Sousa. We nickname him Sticks because he's always running around with a crutch or crutches, if you will. We used to call some people Aaron. Aaron, we called him Adam because he lost two toes for his diabetes, you know. We called him Adam. You hang around this program long enough, all of a sudden you kind of get a little bit of a nickname, you know. Mine started out as asshole and it hasn't changed. I don't know. You know, where Gary is concerned, he passed away because he couldn't get this program. I was his very first sponsor about 25 years ago. Something like that. He got 7 years of sobriety. Did really good. Did an excellent fourth and fifth step. Moved on to six and seven. Was doing some work with his family and making amends and doing some of the things that he should have been doing all the whole time. But he didn't. And he drank again. And he got sober again. And he drank again. He got sober again. And he drank again. He got sober again. The last time I understand, he ended up in Kauai Delta with just about every organ in his body bleeding. And he passed. I went to his celebration of life. And a very dear friend of mine was the minister for it. His name is Jimmy White. Some people know Jimmy. And Jimmy was the minister for the... And Jimmy said an awful lot about Gary, about what was going on. And he also mentioned, he says, if there's anybody else who would like to make any comment, please feel free to come up to the podium. Not one solitary soul came up to the podium. I wanted to, but it's like I turned to one of the guys that Jimmy and I both know, and I said, you know, I want to go up there, but I'm kind of waiting for somebody in his family, one of his boys or one of his daughter or maybe even his sisters. Not one solitary soul came up and said anything. Come to find out later, he had already ostracized the entire family. They didn't want anything to do with him. I don't know about anybody else, but I don't want to be that way. I don't know about anybody else. I don't care if you come to my celebration of life. What I care about is I'm going to keep my ass sober and die sober. That guy that I was telling you about, Clancy, I sat with him on his deathbed. He turned to me, and I was going by Paul at the time, and I didn't tell you how my nickname started, but Bo knows, and Ken, and a few other people here. I rode with the fifth chapter, and Bear is my street name, if you will. And, believe it or not, it stuck with me. So did Asshole, but that's for sure. But you know, one of the things that Clancy told me, he says, and Edie, his wife, is in the kitchen and she's yelling through the walls, if you will. You tell Clancy to take that stuff, it's going to ease his pain. And he's laying there in his bed and says, you tell my wife that I don't want any of that crap because I want to die sober. Now, there's kind of a dichotomy there. And the reason for it is it says it in the big book. If we're prescribed something that might help us to ease our pain, do it, you know. But remember to not overdo it, you know. And Clancy just didn't think he had the power to be able to not stop once he got started. I left his house, 9 or 10 o'clock at night. And he passed about 2 o'clock in the morning when he called me. She said, you know, we're probably going to have a celebration of life. I said, that's fine. She said, I know you're probably not going to be there. I said, I don't know. She said, you were the last sober person to see him still alive. And I want you to know that he loved you. He was like a father to me. When they had a celebration of life, I was asked to go, and I turned it down. I've been to too many funerals. I've been to too many funerals in the last year that I don't want to go to. By the way, my beautiful bride, Sammy, said to say hi to all you guys, all of you, and to know that she loves you. She's not doing too well. She's on oxygen 24/7 now, and she wanted to be here with me. And the last words out of her mouth was, don't lie. And I think maybe Bo was talking to her because he walked up to me and he said, just remember, I know your story, so don't lie. If anybody hasn't told you today that they love you, I certainly do. Thanks for having me, Brent. Thank you.